agenda is here. Greg, you're up to scribe today. Welcome back. Would you mind?
Sure.
Thanks. Okay, on the agenda today, the first item is something that I didn't put in the email, which is Greg wanted to make sure that we discuss how we're going to get an RDF working group review of the JSON-LD docs, hopefully sooner than later. Yeah, so that's first on the agenda. Then we have issue 153, defining the error handler behavior. Issue 160, which is the property generator around tripping algorithm. Issue 159, which is how we're going to expand and compact language maps. 4, which is the IRI compaction algorithm, which we discussed last week a bit. And then issue 140, which is considering, issue 140 shouldn't be on there issue 140 is on there because we need a resolution that basically says we're not going to work on Objectify Link for the 1.0 API, but we are going to work on it in parallel. To just get a document out there that supports it. Any other updates or changes to the agenda?
To note that I'm probably going to visit Wikimedia Germany in a couple of weeks. I'm taking a trip over there.
Oh, great.
So that will give me a chance to talk to them more about JSON-LD and see where they are. It hasn't been prominent in anything they've been talking about so far.
Okay. Nicholas, you're on the queue, and then Francois.
Am I on the queue?
That
must have been an error.
Well, wait a second. I don't know. Maybe you've been on the queue for, like, weeks. since last week. Francois.
Not unlikely.
Hi. Something that is basically side work for this community group, but there is a technical plenary, there's TPAC coming on in end of October, beginning of November. I don't know if some of you are going to TPAC, I suppose, so at least for the RDF working group meeting. There is a technical plenary during this week on Wednesday, and I happen to be on the program committee for this technical plenary. Mm-hmm. Last year, there were lots of breakout sessions, and this mm-hmm. year is going to be just basically the same. And we're looking for ideas, and basically, given that this community group has been a good success, I wonder if someone would propose some breakout session on JSON-LD, for instance, or something related to JSON-LD, because that sounds like just a good idea to me. So I wonder if someone was interested or not.
I think that's a great idea. I don't have the money or the time to go to TPAC. I don't know if anyone else here has the time or funding to go.
Well, I should be around. I don't think I'm the right person to present JSON-LD. Greg, would you be there?
No, I weighed it, but it just didn't make sense for me to go. So.
Okay, so basically there won't be anyone from this group.
Unfortunately.
Marcus, you're closest, I think, between you and Francois.
Yeah, I'm close, but I don't have the time nor the money to go, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it's too bad that none of us, or we don't have anyone that can go. But at the same time, I don't think it really hurts us all that much. To not have representation there. I think if we had someone there, it would be fantastic to do a breakout session on JSON-LD, but it sounds like we don't have anyone.
Well, I'll be around, but I don't think I can handle that breakout session. I've been mostly silent, as you might have seen. So.
Okay.
You might think of a birds of a feather type session that a lot of people to sort of talk about stuff, but not necessarily anyone in authority. And as I recall from the last TPAC, people just put up things they were interested in on a board. It was sort of an unconference style. And if enough people sign up for it, then there's a session. So it doesn't really require that it be anything that's organized, that's sort of self-organized.
Yep, indeed. Okay, well, let's see if I have time to prepare something. Okay, well, thanks. I'm done for now.
Mono? Did we lose Mono?
Oh, sorry. I was muted. I was saying that perhaps what we could do is make ourselves available over Skype. I know that's not ideal, but if there's a BOF and there are enough people interested, if someone there, Francois, if you could, set us up with a Skype session, maybe we could chat with some of the folks there about JSON-LD. That said, if the connection's bad, it usually tends to be a pretty terrible experience for everyone. But yeah, so I don't know. I don't know if there's interest in doing the Skype thing. If there's a BOF there, I'd certainly be interested in joining in. But it can sometimes be difficult to participate. Okay. Anything else on the TPAC breakout session? Okay, so next up is the RDF working group review of latest JSON-LD docs. Greg, would you mind giving a quick overview of this?
An issue put on me in order to come up with what the plan was going to be to have a review of some people from the working group that had not really spent very much time on the looking or commenting on the status of the specs before. I don't see here an issue, and I don't think that there was to need a time resolve. Oh, so Sigri and Sandro. Okay, well, Richard certainly has spent quite a bit of time on it, but he and Sandro both volunteered. Sandro apologized in advance for the typical critical way he has of, possibly overcritical way he has of reviewing things. But it is time to get a review. I wasn't really in a position to know what the status was, but I recall there were some changes, particularly in the introduction, that were still pending. So the issue is to, and I think we noted there are 6 open issues relative to the syntax spec. Oh, there's been some change to them since. So I think what we need to come back to tomorrow is basically what the plan is and the time frame for us to have the syntax specification available for review.
Right. So I think we have a number of resolutions in the issue tracker that we could apply to the spec, and I think once we apply those, the spec and the API document are in pretty good shape to do a review. I think it's probably about a weekend's worth of work to apply most of those changes to the spec. So we could theoretically have a new review-ready spec to them by next week. That's a bit it's a bit tight of a timeline, but I could take some time this weekend to do that. We still have, we still have a couple of these outstanding issues, but I think we can just put issue markers in the spec on those and kind of they can just be aware that they exist. Do you think that would work, Greg?
It would be nice to have something that is sort of is an LC type state, but I don't think we're quite there. I think the concern was that it had just been a while before there had been any real review there, and that it was time to do that. So Yeah, I think principally getting the things that the synchronizing the status of the specs, specifically the syntax spec, with our latest reviews. And I think that really gets to, in the introduction, talking about the data model, making sure we're aligned with the RDF concepts, and sort of, I think we were going to remove the statement of sort of linked data manifesto, because that was not ended up to being very useful. That's probably the principal thing, I think, that we want to have in there. Syntactically, I think we've also decided on language maps. I don't know that we have language maps documented in the syntax there.
I think they are.
Okay.
They are in the syntax spec, but missing from the API spec.
Okay. Yeah, it's the syntax spec that they want to review.
Okay. Yeah, so Richard was going to... Richard is the one that took the action to align the document with RDF concepts. That's on him. But everything else we can do, which is the introduction, changing the introduction and modifying that linked data definition section, I have a pretty good idea of how those things need to be changed. So since Richard is reviewing the document, maybe he would also make sure that the two documents were aligned when he does that review. Okay. Yeah. So I think.
Do you want to reach out to him ahead of time to see where he is with?
I'll ping him. Let me put it in action.
Shouldn't we at least decide how language maps and property generators are going to be implemented before we are requesting additional reviews?
I don't think that it's necessary. They're reviewing the syntax document, not the API spec. So the property generator and language map stuff has to do really, it mainly has to do with the API spec and how we do round tripping. The syntax doesn't change all that greatly. I mean, it could change slightly, but it doesn't change like that greatly. So I think it's okay for them to do a review without us getting those things in. I mean, if we resolve something today, definitely we'll put it in there. I'm just a bit hesitant to say that we're going to be able to do that today.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is because there haven't been many changes since the last round of reviews. So I don't know if it really makes that much sense for them to spend time again on it, especially because Richard did a review in July, I think, at least in the syntax spec, there weren't a handful of changes, which were mostly just editorial anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what the DiffMark version is for, right? So Richard would probably, usually when people review the documents multiple times, people tend to just look at the DiffMark versions to see what the differences were from the last one. And if there are not a lot of changes, then the review goes quickly for them. But people like Sandra, who haven't really looked at the document yet, is going to end up doing a full review. So I think that once we commit these other changes, the ones that we have in the issue tracker, there will be a decent bit of significant changes to the introduction and whatnot. But I mean, if they want to do a review, let's give them a document that they can do a review on and kind of move on, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's good that way.
Okay. Anything else on the RDF working group review before we move on? Okay, so the plan is I will take the action to update the spec, the syntax spec, this weekend and integrate all of the changes that we have in the issue tracker. And then we'll get a reviewable spec to them by next week. All right. Anything else on this item before we move on? All right. First issue up is issue 153, defining the error handler behavior for the JSON-LD API. Link is here. If you look at the issue, we have there's at the very, very end, the very last comment is kind of a proposal. Marcus said that he thought that there should be some other items in the error that's returned, and I tried to kind of outline what those extra values should be. And we probably need a bit more than what we have in that last comment now. So let me find a link to the exact location. So this is, I think, the current proposal. So the idea here is that whenever there is a processing error, so let's say you're compacting and there's an error, that you're expanding and there's an error of some kind, there is an if the developer has specified an error handler, the error handler is called, and the error handler has one. The error handler has one. Sorry, I'm thinking about something else right now. The error handler has one argument that's passed to it, which is err, the error that happened. Inside that error, there can be four values so far. So there's the type, which is the type of error that happened. For example, a list of lists has been detected. The operation that it happened on, so compact, expand, flatten. The full JSON-LD object that was being processed when this happened, because some algorithm might need to understand the context in which the error happened, and then the value, the specific value that needs to be corrected in order for the algorithm to proceed. And then the return value from the function would be basically the return value for the function would be whether or not to continue, and then the corrected value. Now, the thing that I was just thinking of is that, you know, perhaps we want there to be two arguments to the function, the error function, the error, and then a callback. And then the callback is basically used if you want to make sure that the value, if you want to call the API in an asynchronous way, if you want to make sure that the error is handled in an asynchronous way, so if it does something that blocks your program can continue, and if you don't specify the callback, then the value is returned immediately, or you block while processing and then you return the value. Any thoughts on this proposal? Any other way that we should potentially do this?
What exactly do you mean by data? So you say it's the complete JSON-LD object being processed. Is it like the input document or?
The input document, I think.
Shouldn't that be the state, the sub portion of the document that you were processing when the error?
Possibly, but the issue is that the algorithm may need information from somewhere else in the document to make a decision on what needs to be done.
Perhaps we need to pass both things in, or we need to pass in the document and something like a JSON pointer.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Normally the document object would be, I mean, the user of the API, the creator of this function, would normally have access to the object elsewhere, but it's probably good to have that as well. But I think that it's also good to have the key for the current value and the owner of that key and value. So something like the parent, parent key and value, in addition to or complementing the data. And the data could be called root.
Do we think that we need more than just the parent, like the parent's parent and that parent's parent, things like that? Do we think that that's necessary?
Well, you could have some kind of path, but I mean, then you're into complex. I think we should opt for something simpler, like the parent. I mean, if you're in a list, you should also return the position in that list in that case, and we're wearing into very complex territory if we do that.
And Greg, you had suggested that maybe we want to use JSON pointer, that maybe we want to go there?
Well, that would be a way for us to use existing specifications in order to locate yourself within the document. So that would handle the list case and everything else. It does mean for an implementation having to either create an implementation or make use of some library that implements JSON pointer to it. It also adds some complexity to the processing algorithm because it needs to maintain its sort of current location as a in a pointer fashion, but it's not unlike what we have to do with the RDF. What I do anyway in RDFA, where I maintain sort of my document location. I think the requirement there for the processing graph is to use some form of a location, or there's a recommendation to use some form of a XPath locator or something like that.
We can have a should. Is JSON pointer a final spec?
No, I'm just looking at it right now. The intended status of its it's informational. Mark Nottingham's working on it. Expires March 9th, 2013. It says it's an internet
draft.
Do you
have a link?
Yeah, Let me give you a...
But that's the one that uses slashes instead of dots, right? I've been a bit confused about that. It looks so...
Slash reference token.
I would rather have some kind of literal representation of how you would access the current document in JavaScript. You know, like, attribute dot... Or even better brackets, because we don't always have... I mean, we can have slashes in our keys, so you never know what... If you have an expanded document, that wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm pretty wary of doing anything with something that's the attempts to use JSON pointer or any kind of path-based thing. I understand the intent, meaning it makes it really easy to figure out exactly where what you're talking about. The concern I have is that it would really complicate the implementation, and we would do that for what benefit, right? I mean, why is it that important? So, for example, if someone needs to find that reference in the document, they can do that because they have a reference to the value and they have a reference to the document. So they could search the entire document for that reference if they needed to. But I would expect that in many cases they would never need to look outside of the value that was given. And even if they needed to do that, they can do that by just searching for the reference.
At least the key, though, wouldn't be good. Or the attribute.
Well, I mean, you can figure out what the key is because you have a reference to the value, unless it's like a simple value, you'd be able to find it.
It could be that like a year was used in two different positions, say, and searching for it wouldn't be adequate, but it's only illegal in one of them. A list might have the value a couple of times, and not raise an error the second time. But
if you give them the term string, they can check in the context what it should mean.
The other potential possibility is we give them the entire document, the parent object, and then the value. I mean, we could give them everything, the entire object, the parent, the key, and the value. And I think given those things, we don't need JSON pointer.
No.
And then the question, you don't need JSON pointer to find which item you're talking about in the document, right?
I think it would be enough the minimum should be value, the term and the value, and if the processor can, they should give the parent and the root. I mean, you could have some kind of streaming processor or something which just lets go of the previous visited items.
I think what Greg's saying, though, is that if you just give them the key and the value, you can have that key and value be duplicated in two places in the document, for example, in two different objects. So it wouldn't be enough to figure out uniquely which, key-value pair you're talking about.
No, that's true, but you would be able to figure something out. And if you want to figure out where, you should give them the parent and ideally the root as well.
Right, exactly. So I think that the argument is if we want to say no to JSON pointer, we need to ensure that we have something that accomplishes the same thing in a much more difficult way, meaning that if we don't give them JSON pointer, they can still figure out which item's being talked about in the error. And in order to make that happen, it has to be more than just the key and the value. It has to be the parent, the key, and the value at a minimum, and more than likely it's the document, the parent, the key, and the value.
The thing is, this is exactly what JSON pointer is designed to do. And, I think that if there are concerns about the format that they've chosen for JSON pointer, then it seems to me there's some public feedback needed in order to indicate why that doesn't satisfy our purpose. I mean, it is still a draft.
That's my primary concern.
Well, yeah, it just seems like if specifications should borrow from other specifications where it makes sense. And something like a JSON pointer is not a core concern of what we're doing. And there is a specification for doing this. Granted, it is a draft specification, but then so is ours. But yet we encourage people to use JSON-LD.
I think the issue is that JSON-LD wouldn't hit a rec until JSON pointer reached the same status, and I don't know what the timeline for that is. And it seems. I don't think it's a good idea to hold the JSON-LD API up just because JSON pointer hasn't reached a rec or an official internet specification or an IETF spec. That's the only concern. Like if JSON pointer was done today, I'd say absolutely we should do that. But it doesn't look like it is. Meaning that since it's not done and since it is a draft, it means that the JSON-LD specs are going to be held up until, or at least the JSON-LD API spec is going to be held up until JSON pointer's done. And they have a, an expiration of March 9, 2013, and it's probably not going to go to official status until after that.
Yeah. I just that we're sort of a hate to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, I agree.
Well,
I agree.
I agree that we can't because we have to wait, but I also don't think that I think that using a string to represent the path is overkill, and it requires the user to have a JSON pointer implementation parse the string, and the result of that parsing would be something that we can produce just by providing the value of the path being a list of the keys used to go from the root to the current value. The keys would be strings or integers. With that, you can uniquely find the value from the root.
Sorry, I haven't been paying attention to the queue. Francois, you're on the queue. You might be muted, Francois. Still can't hear you.
Sorry, I was muted. So the ACK is not enough to unmute me. Okay. I'm just trying to digest what Nick has just said. It sounds like not such a bad idea. I have the same concern as Manu. Having been involved in other standards before, I'm pretty sure we can just end up being blocked just because JSON pointer hasn't reached a standard level sufficiently soon enough. And the error property seems to be not core to the API. So I was wondering whether we could turn the whole thing into something that is informative instead of normative, meaning that apart from the properties that we really want to define normatively, we could perhaps have an informative section that explains that to get the path to the incriminated key you chosen conformant engines are required to recommend that they use JSON pointer, but as an informative recommendation. I'm not sure if I'm clear, but because informatively we can reference drafts, it's not a problem, but normatively we're going to end up with problems.
Right. Marcus, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I'm a bit concerned with the overall approach. I think we are taking that too far, because even if you receive such an error event, then you would basically, you would have to know all the internals of the processor, and if you know that already, you could write it yourself. I mean, either you program your error handler to handle a specific error and you know what the date and the value would look like, and if that's the case, you can pre-process the data as well. And the other thing is, if we have that return value, or that while the error handler modifies the data, returns that to the processor, which then has to evaluate it again, you might even end up in an endless loop, for example. Or, at least you have to check it twice. And even that is not that trivial, in my opinion. So perhaps we should just keep it simple, pass on, an error type, perhaps an error message, and the return values just continue, which would mean ignore that part, or break, or stop, and the processor would stop processing that input.
Okay, so what you're proposing is that we, instead of attempting to correct it, the only choice you have is ignore and continue, or stop.
Yeah, because honestly, I can't really see how you could correct it, in real time, or I don't know how to say, while running it, if you don't know what errors you expect, and if you know what errors you have to expect, you can as well pre-process the input, which would be much simpler.
Yeah, I think I agree, that's the simplest choice, and it seems, I think it's a good reasoning.
Okay. to go back to what Francois said, I definitely get where you're going with the informative reference to it. Since it's in the JSON-LD API and since it's a part of the API, the actual, like, the API proper, I don't think we can be informative there, even with values. And we could say something really kind of, we could have some weasel wording in there, which is basically, you know, if you want to, you can specify, you know, if a developer would prefer to use JSON pointer to specify, they can use this value, like, let's just say the value is called JSON pointer. And you can specify JSON pointer to the value there. But that's not required. I don't know if that can be said in informatively. It's kind of a weird situation where you're saying it's an optional feature, but even when you have an optional feature in a W3C spec, I think if you decide to implement the feature, you must reference and you must do it normatively. You must reference a normative spec to do it. Have you had any experience to the contrary of that, Francois?
I don't have any good example in my mind right now, but I can check. In the end, you would end up with something that you may not like, meaning that the informative section would just really be just informative. The goal of it is basically just to say, well, maybe we'll consider doing it normatively in version 2 or version 3, but right now it's just a suggestion, not to... it's really just talking for talking. So in the end, the net result is basically that you're not specifying the precise syntax and just the processors. But it seems, I would rather leave it this way and ensure that the spec can move forward than being locked just by an error definition.
Okay. Greg, you were on the queue. Was it basically to say what Francois just said?
Well, what I was going to say is that, again, in RDFA, we provided for different ways of specifying alternate information, like XPath, I think. Perhaps there's a way to have some options that could be added that allows for things like this to be specified. But, you know, really, again, if you're going to do that and it's not normative, it's really not useful, probably. I mean, it might be, but it's not something you can count on, so it's probably not worth our time to try to make that, all of that work.
Okay. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
I think that the point that Marcus raised is a very good one. Perhaps we could even leave the return value to be just true and false and don't allow any correction at this point.
I think if we do that, if we want to leave the door open for correction, we should still use the data structures that I'm proposing there. I do like the simplicity of Marcus's proposal. I'm concerned that there's no correction stuff in there. I don't know if the correction stuff is useful or not. Meaning that it seems to be the correction stuff seems to be associated with kind of a corner case. Like, for example, in a list of lists, perhaps you do want to actually process that list in a certain way. But as Marcus said, you know, maybe you just run a pre-processing step over your data to make sure it's in the correct format before you feed it into JSON-LD.
Yeah, I'm thinking so because if of course, that's more complex, but if we go down the route of providing path information and the global object for processing, that's also not so simple. And as Marcus said, it can lead to very strange scenarios if you have cyclic data, something like that. And given that providing that path information suggests that you can do invasive correction, it's probably better to do that off the regular parsing prior to that, or just halting and fixing and then rerunning the processing. I mean, we should have more demand and real scenarios before we add this feature, I think.
Okay. Okay, so then what could potentially happen is we could keep the data structure, so you keep type, so you know what error type you had, you keep the operation. We could remove data and replace it with something like key. So we could have the key and the value where the error happened, so that the person can at least print out, you know, the piece of data that was involved. But then we could make the return value basically true or false. True means ignore and continue. False means throw an error and stop. I still haven't completely given up on the correction stuff. So could we make the return type return continue true and continue false in an object, so that if we need to in the future modify this so that you can correct the data, we have that data structure in place there?
The other
alternative is to allow the return value to be two different things. It's either you get true or false back, which basically true means ignore and continue, false means stop, or you get an object back which tells you what the corrected value and all that kind of stuff is. Any thoughts on that, one way or the other?
We're going to try to define this with WebIDLE, I guess. So I guess we could do that with a variant type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Seems to me we should just stick with an object return, which allows for the most extension in the future. Just true and false seems like we're boiling it in a little bit too tightly.
Mm-hmm.
And for that matter, I don't know if we discussed before, I mean, if false basically says abort, then isn't that something that could be done through the exception mechanism without having to deal with return value?
Say that again, Greg?
Well, if the values true and false mean sort of ignore and continue, and false means stop processing, couldn't that just be handled by the invoking context, having an exception handler, and then having the error handler raise an exception?
It can just throw the input error. Throw error.
It's sort of like I guess in JavaScript there's sort of a bubbles, don't bubble type concept for events. That's not really quite the same thing. In my case, in my typical programming, I would throw an exception, and then I would handle that exception in an outer context. That sort of gets around the need to return a value which says stop processing. So you think you either want to ignore it, or you're going to abort the whole operation, for which the exception mechanism might even be more useful, because then you get the whole stack trace and whatnot that might be more useful for other purposes.
The only concern I have with throwing an exception is whether or not that exception would bubble up to the proper place if you're calling all this stuff asynchronously. think it would, but I'm not positive about that. I'm thinking mostly in JavaScript.
Well, it doesn't matter if you or the caller of the handler does it, because that's a synchronous call anyway. It's reminiscent of, if you don't have an error handler, that you would throw the original exception, right? I mean, the processor would throw the original exception. You wouldn't...
It might throw a slightly different one, but yeah.
Because if it would throw... It would be good if the error handler is just an error interceptor with the ability of stopping and just continuing.
Well, does the error handler, I mean, the error handler, is it defined as an exception handler? I think it's a function call, is it not?
Yes. Yeah.
So there is one of the things that's handed to the API is a reference to the error handler, and then that is invoked when a condition is found. It's not like it's an exception is raised, and this is sort of a handler which is inserted to handle the exception. I think we originally were using exceptions, and we decided to use this error handler instead in order to give the programmer more options for how to deal with such errors.
Yep. Yeah, so I agree that I don't think that we want to use this thing as some kind of exception intercept mechanism. I think I agree with what Greg's saying. I think we made this decision to have an error handler function that's called before you throw any kind of exception, because we wanted the developer to be able to control the process before any kind of exception is thrown. The only time the exception is thrown...
Well, we introduced the error handler because we changed from synchronous to asynchronous style. So we have a callback instead of a return value, and that's why we introduced an error handler. The idea of a superaction came up later on.
It didn't happen like that in my head, but I could be remembering incorrectly. In any case, it's neither here nor there for the solution that we have or that we're talking about now. So, how does this sound for a proposal? The error that you get will have a type and operation, the key and the value, and the return type will be an object that will either have continue set to true or continue set to false in it. If the developer wants to throw an exception, they can do so in the error handler, but that's not really how the system's designed. If they return a continue false from the error handler, then an exception will be thrown by the JSON-LD processor. Does that seem like a reasonable design for this?
Well, I think it's really odd to say that if you return false, an exception will be thrown, when it's just as easy to have the error handler throw an exception. And that would even allow the user more options to define different types of exceptions that it wants to handle using application-specific language. So saying return false so that an exception is thrown, it just doesn't seem very useful.
But they can always...
But did you say otherwise the processor throws an exception, or will the processor just stop?
Well, I mean, I would expect that when the processor stops, it would notify the developer in some way that the processing failed. And the way that's typically done is you throw an exception.
Well, it did notify it by calling the error handler.
Yeah,
that's true, but
So you're saying don't throw an exception? We're inventing too much stuff here.
Sorry, say that again, Greg?
It just feels like we're inventing too much stuff. We're sort of making this up as we go along, and that worries me.
Well, are you saying then don't throw an exception, just let them deal with the error or continue?
Well, I think, okay, so I think the reason we went here originally was before we had separated out the API to be totally asynchronous, and it was to give the user more options for how to deal things. Either, and it was either basically continue processing, possibly allowing some modification of the input to allow it to continue, or stop. And I think in my mind, it was always the way that it would stop processing is by throwing an exception. So you might say that any return is treated as discontinue processing and continue. Rather, ignore the current input value and continue processing. And if the programmer wants to do anything else, you throw an exception. I think this is, to Marcus's point, this is also made necessary because of the asynchronous nature of processing. But that's also entirely consistent with doing the exception-based processing stuff. So I guess I would say that we do return a structure which includes some information which may be used by the processor in the future to provide finer granularity. But at this point, the actual return content of that is ignored, and the current input is ignored, and we continue processing the input stream. If the user wants to abort processing, they throw an exception.
Hi, Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, what happens when an exception is thrown? Since it is asynchronous, you won't have any...
Sorry, mute.
There we go. There we go.
Right. when an exception is thrown, since we're in something asynchronous, it doesn't get intercepted by, you can't catch it. So by definition, it stops processing. Well, not by definition, we have to have that in the contract because the caller of the error handler could catch any exception if we don't specify that.
Yeah, I'm concerned about. Greg, I don't quite agree with Greg's statement that we're inventing new stuff, because this is kind of the way the Node.js stuff works. Like all of it works, and at least, you know, the middleware for things like Express, you know, if there's an error that's called, you get an error callback, or you get an error handed to you. Actually, I guess that's true. You get an error that's handed to you, and then you decide what to do with the error. You can either throw the error or raise the error or throw your own error, or you can ignore it and continue. So I guess that's what Greg is saying. I just unmuted you again, Greg. I guess...
That's pretty much what I was saying, is you either throw an error, and perhaps you throw the error you were given, or you return, in which we continue processing. Because I think in any case, I'm in a, you know, this, even though I'm being called asynchronously, it's done from a context, right? It's done in JavaScript. There is a method call that includes the callback, which of course has various other callbacks internally. But if I throw an exception, oh, I guess I say it doesn't necessarily get handled by that point.
Right.
Well,
it would be handled by. But that happens all the time in JavaScript, I guess. My point, Nicholas, is that that yes, the original caller is not going to be able to catch that exception, but That happens all the time in JavaScript anyway, so I don't think it's a big deal.
No, but the final callback, well, that gets the exception eventually, right? It ends up in the...
If we have the second argument being a callback, yes.
Yeah.
Typically, let me put in the function signature here. So you've got error, handle, error, it would be here, error and callback. This is a pretty typical Node.js, you know, callback. This is the asynchronous mechanism that Node.js and basically all browsers use, right? You get the error, and then you decide what you want to do with the error. If you just want to pass the error up the stack, you do callback, and then you pass error to callback. And then the callback would take an error value and then the object. Right. You would call this. If you wanted, this is, I think, what Greg is proposing, just pass the you know, object back. The error would be null. Let me be specific. If you wanted to propagate the error back up to the original caller, you would do callback error. Right? If you wanted to ignore the error, you would do callback null, and that would tell it to continue processing. Right. And then if you wanted to...
No, but how should that work?
Sorry, would this be continue processing?
But wait, do you call the error handler asynchronously?
I think the only point of calling a callback is to get back into the calling context that was called. It's not really, it's sort of a textual or it's a scope. It's not something that really allows you to return out of that. And so I think that if you call the callback, I guess I just don't really see the point of callback. If you call the callback, you are providing information that can be used from that call in context. If you don't call it, then it's as if it didn't happen. So a way to continue would be to just not call the callback.
I don't know where we are anymore in the stack of callbacks.
Hold on. There is a standard way that you do error handling in Node.js, and it's slowly moving its way back into the browser. So if you look at the async library, things like the async library, that's kind of started out in the Node.js world and moved over to the browser. This pattern of having error as the first argument and callback as the second argument to do every kind of asynchronous processing, like that, this is like established practice, right? So if we want to do stuff asynchronously, this is the way to do it. Like, I don't think this is not a new thing or something new that we're inventing. This is the standard mechanism that JavaScript, especially Node.js, uses for doing asynchronous calls. So basically, when there's an error, handle error is called with the error, and then the callback is the callback that the processor will basically inject a callback in there what the processor is doing is saying, developer, handle this error, and then when you're done handling the error, call the callback. Now, the developer is going to do one of two things. They're going to call the processor's callback with an error, or they're going to call the processor's callback with null for the error, and then the values that are basically defined. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not the way error handlers are used in callbacks for things like XML HTTP requests and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah, that's old school. That's the old design. That, like, people have definitely moved away from that.
I think that I'm in doubt that every user return will be replaced by callbacks, because that's
the
direction that is
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but that direction is, I mean, eventually someone will say, can't we use return instead and redesign the language, because it's getting callbacks for everything, and that's, I mean, for an error handler, just being a function, unless that handler is going to, like, write something to disk asynchronously and then ask the processor to continue processing, that would be serious overkill for a simple error interceptor. I think
I guess that's the standard model for Node.js. Everything's asynchronous. I agree with you that, yeah, it would be simpler if it was just a return value, but we can't assume that the error processing is going to be able to make that happen. So, for example, if they need to log the error to disk, that has to be done asynchronously. Or rather, it would be very bad for us to force them to do that synchronously.
Well, but, I mean, before the error handler returns, the processor can decide whether it should continue or not anyway.
No, every visit would have to every node would have to be asynchronous.
Yes, that's the way Node.js works, right?
Not for everything.
Yeah,
not
but
for
the parts
not
where
for a parser internals.
No, for parser internals as well. It's all asynchronous.
No.
I'm making an assertion here, but this is the way the system's designed. There's no way to get around this. Like, if you look at every Node.js library, they are designed like this. So I'm a bit confused because this is standard practice. Are you guys saying that this is?
I think maybe we need to a proposal. I mean, I don't know that we can do that right now. I think this probably needs more work on the issue that has a substantive proposal, perhaps with references to the common practices that we can use to substantiate what we're doing. And then if we add this to the spec, it probably similarly needs to reference sort of the practices, at least informatively, that were used in order to define our error handling behavior.
Sure. Go ahead. I'm talking too much.
No.
If we are
going to do it by that design, we would need to pass the active context and basically everything to call again the internal expand, compact, or whatever call of the API and do that over again. Otherwise, we couldn't do it asynchronously anyway, could we?
We could. I don't see any reason why we couldn't do that. Dave's chiming in, but I don't think that there's anything preventing anything preventing the processor from continuing from when it called the error handler, because that's what the callback does. When the callback's called again, the processor will continue processing.
Yeah, but either you stop the processor for the time being, then it's synchronous, or you have a callback which needs all the state to continue again. So you stop it and then you restart it, basically.
No, you don't need that, because the processor already has all the state, because it's in a closure in JavaScript. You don't need to pass any of that stuff to the callback because of the way that JavaScript is designed.
Closure has all the state in there, so.
Right, exactly. So you have all that, and you call after the callback, and the callback returns back, and the closure that says this is what you do when you continue already has access to all the information in the JSON-LD processor.
Well, I'm fine in principle for doing this, because it does make sense to me that we have an asynchronous model. We continue to do everything asynchronously, including error handling. But I just think there's a lot of sort of hand-waving going on right now, and we need something more substantive. Otherwise, we'll just talk about this forever.
Where do you think the hand-waving is? Actually, Francois's on the queue. Sorry.
So, you mentioned that it was common practice in Node.js, but I'm wondering if you have an example, because as far as I can tell, here we're having a two-step error mechanism, and I say two-step, and just mean that handled error in your example is already an error callback, so actually giving it to, there aren't so many, I can't find any example in Node.js that has a continuation.
Search for ERR in that document and look at how every single error handler has this pattern. Well, except for the Ferrets example.
I think this makes sense because you're asynchronous, and so you're going to have to. You can't communicate by a return value. You've got to communicate by a callback.
Right.
It just sounded like there's enough uncertainty in the air here that we probably need something that's more a formal proposal that describes exactly what we're going to do.
That's fine. I'll take an action to write that up. Let me show you guys a couple of other ones, though.
Maybe we should get a sense if everyone, you know, what the straw poll as to what people feel about using a callback for communicating the status of the error handler.
So I'm still, just to state that I'm still a bit lost, confused, because even in Express, as you mentioned, the error handler signature is actually only takes an error. It doesn't take a callback. It just happened that there is a next function that is being called internally.
But that's the callback. It just so happens that you have. You have access to that because of the closure. Hold on, let me. I'm pretty sure there was one in there. Error user. Okay, let me find the async library. So this is another library that has the error mechanism. And there's also a link in there from Dave Longley about exception handling. Best practices.
But async as well, you don't have an error handler that has that takes a callback as a.
It does. Look at the very last argument for. Look at the very last argument for async.parallel. And the for each iterator takes a callback as the last argument.
But that's just the last callback. It's just the last. The error function in async. It's not the, well, I may write it down because it's probably going to be easier to write things down than just explain them orally, but in async as well, you don't, the error handler signature is not, doesn't take a callback as that parameter. Your handle error in your example is an error callback, right? Already.
Well, look at the other. Let me put this another way. Every asynchronous mechanism. Go ahead.
I get what you're trying to do. You're basically saying that if the error handler needs to be async for some reason, then it should have a callback. It should receive a callback as parameter because that's the only way you can say,
right.
Well, I'm done.
Right.
So I get that. It's just doesn't seem to be common to me. But
the pattern the pattern of calling a callback in an asynchronous mechanism is the thing that I'm saying, you know.
The pattern of calling the callback within an error handler is already a callback is actually not that common.
Not that common?
Sending a callback to a callback, it's not that common.
Yeah,
I mean, the pattern of using callbacks is common, but...
Francois, you're saying sending a callback to an error handler is not common, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I guess my argument is sending a callback to an something that's supposed to execute asynchronously is very common.
That's fine. If we have we don't have much choice if we think that the processing is going to be async.
Right. Nicholas is on the queue, and then Marcus.
I think that's some earlier queue.
Okay. Marcus.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask if we should postpone the discussion on this issue till we have like a more formal proposal and continue with the next issue, because I think we are getting nowhere at the moment.
Sure. Okay. All right. Anyone object to tabling the issue for now and then moving forward with the next one? Okay. Next up is next up is an easy one. The property generator round tripping algorithm. I don't really know where we are on this particular issue. We never really got around to actually discussing this in depth. I think we ended up talking about the language map stuff, and we never dived very deeply into how this property generator round-tripping algorithm works, meaning that I think we said that there are issues with... there are issues with compaction because one of the options is that there could be something that's very combinatorially complex to run. And we may want an option in the API that lets you say, yes, I want you to do the combinatorially complex thing, or no, I don't want you to do that, and just leave all the values as is. Does anyone else feel that there was we had made progress on this issue to the point that that we have like a proposal that we have consensus on?
No, we never really discussed it.
Okay. I
think that we should. I realized that we should probably resolve issue 113 before that we decided last time to try to simplify the compaction. And based on the success or failure of that, we can decide whether or not we should take all terms into account when compacting the proper generator pattern.
So your proposal is figure out what the language for 113 is going to be and see if that helps us with this issue.
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, we wouldn't really know if we can do all the things that we want to do with compaction, and that would give us an indication as to whether or not it would be feasible to do something which isn't high fidelity when we try to compact having a property generator in the context.
Hmm. Okay.
The problem with property generators is also that there might be a whole subtree under it, so I don't know if it's even feasible to check, like, if the whole subtree is the same. It's not just that there is just a value, there could be, like, a whole tree under it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could say that feasible because we have a normalization algorithm and we can actually, you know, normalize to see if they're two identical things, but that's incredibly costly.
Like, of course, if everything is possible, but if it makes sense.
When we introduced the property generator, I think that we said that it's likely that we won't use it for compaction at all. I think because of that, and I think that given the choice of either not using it or using it, even if there is only one of the several properties that apply, I prefer to do nothing, because otherwise, as we said in other cases, we create we do things which aren't round trippable.
We create
data.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of the issue, is that there's data being created, whereas nothing else in the JSON-LD syntax really does that.
So I prefer to ignore those.
Yeah, I guess the problem is that the Drupal community wants something that they can use a property generator on, expand, and then compact and get the exact same thing that they started with. And we can accomplish that, but the algorithm for doing that is very, very costly, or could become very costly.
Yeah.
And the way that we said that we'd get around that is we'd give them a flag that says, yes, I want you to do the full, you know, compacting for the property generator, for property generators, knowing that if you've turned that flag on, you could spend a lot of time, you know, spinning, processing things.
Yeah.
And is creating new data sort of a non-starter for them, or?
Well, I mean, they want to create new data, right? I mean, they wanted this specifically. I mean, I think Lynn wanted the property generator so that they could express both Dublin Core and Schema properties using a single value.
So if the problem, as I understand it, is that on expansion, a single term can result in multiple IRI properties and duplicated values. And if when you compact, you only have one of those, and you select that same term, then you end up creating effectively a new term that's in there. And I'm just wondering if that's a problem. I don't think that's really a problem. If that's the case, then I think the combinatorial issue sort of is solved, because if you find any property, you can use the sort of the property generator term. And the corner case is where the original input only specified one of the property IRIs that's specified in the property generator, but we choose that term anyway. And I just don't know if that's really something we should worry about.
We can check with Lynn again, but I thought that she basically said that it would be confusing if they compacted, expanded, and continue to like generate more data while they're doing that, or new data.
Well, it shouldn't. That shouldn't be the case, because if they're consistently using, if they have something that uses a property generator term and it expands to two terms, when we compact, we choose the property generator again, but it should only result in one output. Otherwise, it would be the same term was chosen, but the values were duplicated. And I just don't think that's what we do. So I would go through and I would probably record when I chose the property generator for the first property IRI when doing compaction, I would sort of record that fact so that when I saw the next IRI, I would know that we had already chosen something. I guess the problem, and again, these are sort of theoretical corner cases where you have, let's say you have a schema name and DC title, and they contain different values.
Mm-hmm.
Then, yeah, but that's, again, that's sort of a theoretical problem. That's not what's going to come from their expanded data. That's going to come when trying to compact something that's arbitrary. But if we took something that was specified with a property generator and expanded it, you'd get two IRI properties with equivalent values, as long as when we compact that and choose the property generator, it only results in the property generator term and a single value, then we wouldn't get a continuous explosion of data.
So are you saying effectively then that the term ranking algorithm would always consider a property generator term before anything else, and it would use that? It would always use the property generator term before anything else when compacting?
Well, I don't know if it would always choose it before anything else, but that it would choose it without regard to whether there was, without having to look at every property that was in the object to make sure that all of them were specified equivalently. So it might choose it in preference to anything else, but I think that's sort of an orthogonal question.
Well, I guess I don't understand it. So let's say you've got a property generator foo, and there are three IRIs it expands to. Let's just say IRI 1, 2, and 3. So whenever you use foo, when you expand, you'll have IRIs 1, 2, and 3. And then when you compact again, 1 is going to be compacted to foo, 2 is going to be compacted to foo, and 3 is going to be compacted to foo. And theoretically, all of those values should be the same. So you're going to end up with an array of three values in them that are identical. That, or when you're compacting, before you merge this stuff into the array, you check to see if all the values are the same. And if they are, then you just keep the same value. So for example, you check to see if a foo already exists in the current level of the object. If it does, you check the value of foo, and if it matches your value that you're compacting, then you just effectively throw it away because it's already represented there via foo.
Well, one of the things that we sort of bypassed before when doing compaction is whether we should remove duplicate values. And I think we decided not to, but in the RDF model, except for lists, there can't be duplicates. So if we instead reexamined that and did duplicate removal, then I think that would address the concern you have.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that duplicate
removal. We would add the three equivalent values, and then they would get removed as part of that step.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that the duplicate removal step happens during the process. You just have a check in there to see if it matches the first item in the list. And if it does, then, you know, that's that. Nicholas, sorry, you've been on the queue.
Yeah, I think it was, I realized that what Greg said makes sense in that given a flag which has to be used explicitly, we, given the proper documentation, can say that, well, basically, property generators in context with property generators should only be used on data which you're aware of or know of somehow. You shouldn't use them otherwise. And given that, we could simplify the algorithm really much by just using the first value in the property generator to compact the term, because you sort of expect that the data you want to compact has the same value for all the things that are given for a term with a property generator, all IRIs for the properties. Given that you have to use a flag for it, you won't accidentally create any data. You have to explicitly force the processor to do that. And using that flag, you should read the documentation, which should say this.
Because what does the flag do, Nicholas?
The flag should enable property generators. It should be something like use property generators true false and default is false. By using true, you are prepared to accept that the context you use. Every term that has a property generator will only create round-trippable data if your input data has the same value for all those properties.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simplest solution to that, because as you've said, otherwise we have to check the duplicates and do all kinds of heavy processing for this.
Well, I guess the duplicate checking isn't too terrible if you use the algorithm that Greg outlined, right? Because, I mean, it grows linearly, I think.
Yeah.
Rather than before, which it was this huge combinatorial issue.
Yeah.
I think the key here is that In the term selection algorithm, you have to process property generator terms first. You know, if we're doing this in multiple rounds, like we discussed, you know, last week, the first round is you check. You know, you check lists first, and then you check language, and then you check property generators, and then you check single terms. And if you follow that, then we have a linear. The algorithm is a linear complexity algorithm. It's n, I think. Does anyone disagree? Does that seem right?
I think so.
Okay. Well, that's good, because I thought it was going to be more difficult than that, which probably means we're missing something. Okay. So is that the algorithm we're proposing to resolve the round trippability issue? We would modify the compaction algorithm such that it would consider property generator terms before any other term, and then it would just every time you find something else that matches the property generator, you check to see if there's that entry already in the object, and if it is already there, you check the value to see if it's already in the object, and if it's not, you add it to the end of the array. If it does exist, you just throw it away. You throw away the key value that you're processing because it's already represented in the compacted form.
What do we do with this? Do we check the whole list?
I think we have to. Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, the value is a list. If you're using property generators with lists, then the list is the value. So you can't do insertion into a list, otherwise the order means nothing. It's got to be that there are two. If I see a second term, a second IRI with a list value, and there is already a first term that had a list value, that the two lists are equal. Otherwise, it's two values with two different lists. Or rather, it's one value with two lists, one key with two list values. Sorry.
Right. Okay. Does that answer your question, Marcus?
Yeah, it does, but doesn't make it really simpler. I mean, again, you have to check whole subtrees potentially.
Yeah.
Which is not that trivial.
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, you can do.
And
I
not
mean,
cheap at all.
Right.
Partly cheap, not the whole subtree. To the if you have IDs, you only have to check the IDs, right? And the.
I don't know if you have to just do that.
Well, you could but potentially.
The members. Could you though? I mean, the membership is enough. If you find that the JavaScript object represents the resource, if there's a value, you have to check all the keys in the value, i.e. language and value or data type and value. Well, type and value. If there's an ID, the expressed information is enough.
Yeah, but it isn't guaranteed that all the information is the same in all the like node definitions in every list. So you could have the same nodes there, but different properties for those nodes. And if you don't check that, you might lose some data.
Almost be better to restrict this to working on flattened data.
Ooh. Yeah.
Or we can just throw an error and tell them that they need to not use deeply nested objects for property generators.
Well, I think that might in fact be the solution. I don't think that the Drupal use case uses sort of deep object nesting under each of these. That's fine. I think they're using scalar values.
Yeah,
so sure.
Or links. But I think that the flattened, I mean, I have a bit of a problem with expanded forms not always being flattened, actually, but I because that's so odd data. But for this case, that would really help. I mean, that solves the entire subtree issue. The problem is that we don't know. Well, we could say that as well if we for the documentation of the flag that for this to be guaranteed not to lose any data, the expansion have to be used with the flattened set to true prior to the compaction with this call.
Have we had any other requests for this except from Drupal?
No, and I mean it's really at this point I would love to just drop the feature, but I don't think that I think they really need it.
We have talked about it when we've compared JSON-LD to RDFA, which has this, so to speak. So it's come up sometime before, I think, as an ID. We don't use this.
If I go back to what Lynn had asked for, the reason that they don't want to, I mean, let's say you don't have property generators, so basically what they need to do is they need to express, title in two different ways, schema title and DC title, so it doubles the amount of data that they're expressing. But when... And they said that they don't care about RDF. So I guess I don't really understand why do they need property generators if they don't care about RDF? I guess is my
question. I think they care about RDF to some extent. I mean, when the going gets tough, as it did with language mapping, is that that's... That's when the concern about RDF isn't important because that case happened because they wanted to represent a basically internal data structure as isomorphically as possible in the JSON and we won't have time today to discuss it, but that's basically because there are very odd implicit properties there going on. In this case, they want this because they use RDFA and they want to be able to use this because consumers of the RDF specifically will look for different properties based on context. The thing they don't care about here, of course, is the potential of using vocabulary expansion, which could be done on the RDF level to solve the issue. But search engines don't use that at the moment.
Okay, well, it seems that we have a solution that we're still a bit uneasy about because there are these complexities of these complex trees, object trees, underneath. Okay, well, I mean, at least it's progress. I think that we can implement a basic version of this, certainly, that we're happy with the performance characteristics of it. And if people start doing deeply nested objects with property generators, we could, for JSON-LD 1.0, just throw an exception, throw an error, and say, no, you can't do that. It has to be simple values or lists or something that's easy to process. All right. We're over time. Anything else that we need to discuss before we get off the phone for this week?
Well, while I've had you here, I wanted to ask if you had the time to think about the example that Alex blogged about, which I sort of complained a bit about on off list, using a very strange type value for links.
Yeah, I agreed with you. I don't really have any other thoughts other than I agree with what you're saying. I think what he's doing is really strange. But he seems to feel like it's perfectly natural to do that, so it's strange. I mean, that's one of the problems with RDF is that you can do that, and it does generate a set of triples, but the interpretation of those is a bit off.
Yeah, the implication is a bit disconcerting because that means that if we don't sort of explain this very concretely, that it might crop up in other places where basically people start abusing type of the way that we feel that rel has been abused.
I agree. I mean, we've been talking about having a best practices document for like 6 years now, and no one's had the time to go off and do that. And I think that's where it would really, you know, belong. That, or I mean, you can write something up really quickly on the website and say these are the best practices when expressing RDFA. And every time we come against one of these concerns or these issues, like what Alex is doing, we can add another entry to the website.
Yeah,
I think that's probably the best place. I mean, if anyone has time to do that, that'd be great. I think the problem has always been that there has always been another priority that's, you know, more important than the best practices document.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
All right.
Before we go? All right. Thanks for the great discussion today, guys. Take it easy.
Thank you.
Great. All right.
You too. Bye.